In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. A month ago, Dr. Martin Paul was on the show discussing links to populations in cities with fifth-generation millimeter-wave wireless radiation systems that are fully installed with the self-driving cars, the whole thing, and the rapid spread of the coronavirus. According to his research, Dr. Paul says there is a connection with adverse human health effects from exposure to wireless millimeter radiation and viral contagion. We also talked about Dr. Tom Cowan's presentation of how during nearly each quantum leap in the electrification of the environment and atmosphere, there has been a corresponding mass sickness, an epidemic or pandemic. Dr. Cowan cites the Spanish flu in 1918 and the turning on of radio antenna worldwide in 1917. Dr. Cowan says on the cellular level, the human body's response to a new atmospheric charge is toxicity. The toxic cells push out proteins, creating a set of symptoms with little evidence of contagion. To sum up, Dr. Martin Paul is saying 5G millimeter wave radiation exposure accelerates the spread of a contagion by causing a range of human health impacts. And Dr. Cowan is saying we need to examine the potential for 5G millimeter wave radiation exposure to cause cells to be toxic that then send viral messages out that the body is in trouble, creating symptoms. On a side note, an interesting publication examining more historic accounts is titled Illustrations of the Atmospherical Origin of Epidemic Disorders of Health, published in 1829. The accentuation of the normal electromagnetic fields brought on by aerial phenomena are suggested to correspond to epidemics such as the Black Plague. Now, bringing it forward again in the timeline, in one account here, the advent of technology that disrupts native electromagnetic fields, and that technology such as 3G, 4G, and 5G, match up with corresponding illness. For example, 3G came out in 2003, and the corresponding illness was SARS. And the symptoms and complications included a high temperature, a fever, extreme tiredness, fatigue, headaches, chills, muscle pain, loss of appetite, diarrhea, a dry cough, breathing difficulty, an increasing lack of oxygen in the blood, which can be fatal in some cases. 4G came out in 2009, and the corresponding illness was H1N1. Symptoms and complication include fever, chills, cough, sore throat, runny or stuffy nose, watery red eyes, body aches, headaches, fatigue, diarrhea, a dry cough, breathing difficulty, nausea and vomiting, worsening of chronic conditions such as heart disease, asthma, pneumonia, neurological signs and symptoms ranging from confusion to seizure and respiratory failure. 5G in 2019, corresponding to COVID-19. Symptoms and complications include fever, dry cough, shortness of breath, runny or stuffy nose, chills, fatigue, sore throat, muscle and joint pain, pneumonia, seizures, respiratory failure. So you have 3G and SARS, 4G, H1N1, 5G, and COVID-19. This really corresponds to this 1829 publication. It corresponds with what Dr. Tom Cowan has brought forward a little over a month ago now. We hear part of an interview with Dr. Tom Cowan on the Wise Traditions podcast hosted by Hilda Labrada-Gore, supported by the Weston Price Foundation. Dr. Cowan is a medical doctor and says we need a better way to determine the source of this infection because it's not clear what is causing the set of symptoms. It is yet to be demonstrated that there are millions of copies of the COVID-19 virus in those who are showing the specific set of symptoms. You'll hear Dr. Cowan say in one of the recent studies to determine infection, and this was against protocol, that the COVID-19 virus wasn't even purified, meaning the solution also contained bacteria, toxins, and other viruses. And that solution was injected into animals to show contagion. However, the mice that got sick from this injection were genetically defective mice, not wild mice that were also injected. So let's have a listen to this part of the interview with Dr. Tom Cowan.
This is a multi-layered, complex story. In fact, I would say to try to understand this, and I would then say, I'm not a little bit sure I don't have a complete understanding of this. I am 100% sure I don't have a complete understanding of this. But here is what I do understand, that if we're confronted, we mean the medical community or the human race or any, you know, either of those, with a new set of symptoms, the question is, how do we know that this new set of symptoms is from an infectious disease? That's the first fundamental question. Now, you know, I've heard from people, and it's interesting what I get from them, because some people will say, well, if a bunch of people have the same symptoms in one place at the same time, that proves it's an infection. But I would submit that that's actually not true, because, for instance, somewhere around 1945, they dropped a bomb on Hiroshima, and I think about 500,000 people died from the same symptoms, and that was clearly not an infection. Now, the similar thing, not as many people, but happened with Chernobyl. So they had this explosion, and then it started to spread across Europe. So people got sick, and some of them died, and you could see then a kind of spread of the disease. And all of us, I think, would agree that there was no evidence that that was an infection. In fact, they were being poisoned by radiation. So the argument that A, that it's spreading, or B, that a lot of people in one place get the same thing, is actually not a scientific proof of infection. Here's another example. You know, people, well, how come three people in my house got sick? So one thing could be somebody put some, you know, arsenic in your water, or somebody put some cyanide in your water, or there could be hundreds of different explanations of that. Now, I'm not saying right now that it wasn't an infection, and it's a sort of interesting thing one might want to examine. My point is, that's not proof of infection. So the question is, how do we prove that it's infection? Now, this question has been answered for, you know, almost 100 years or maybe more. I'm not sure exactly when it started. They're basically called Koch's postulates. Now, I would say that these are sort of timeless postulates. They're just ideas on how this works. Mm-hmm. And so let me describe Koch's postulates. Koch's postulates means that if you have a set of symptoms, let's take an example. You have high fever, you have a rash, you have a stiff neck, you're sicker than you've ever been in ever. And then if nothing is done, that you die in 2 or 3 days. So that's a classic symptom story for something called meningococcal meningitis, which is a kind of meningitis caused by a bacteria called meningococcus. That's Koch's postulate number one. Everybody has more or less the same symptoms. Any reasonable doctor can diagnose that based on the symptoms. Step two is if you examine the blood of all those people with meningococcus, if you lined up 500 people with those symptoms, 100% of them will grow out the bacteria in their blood. Not 80%, not 30%, not 99%, 100%. And if they don't, that means they don't have meningococcus. That's postulate number two. Postulate number three is no normal people walking around, like you or me, presumably you're fine. We don't have meningococcus growing in our blood. And I mean 0% of the time. Because it turns out that having meningococcus growing in your blood is not compatible with walking around. Number four, so that's number three. Number four is you can take that meningococcus, you can purify it so that you only have a pure culture of meningococcus. You could inject that into another person, which you wouldn't want to do, or you can inject it into a susceptible animal, which the animal wouldn't want you to do. But so you do that, and they 100% will get sick, and they'll have the same symptoms, It may be different depending on the species a little bit, but more or less. And then you can grow the meningococcus out of their blood, and you can transfer that to another animal, and on and on. That's how we prove infectious etiology. Now, you can do that with a virus as well. So what is a virus? A virus is a piece of DNA or RNA, a few other proteins, and then it's encapsulated by a piece of your own cell. Now, we're going to get back into that a little bit later, but you could take a common viral disease like chickenpox and say, more or less, everybody with chickenpox has the same set of symptoms, right? Mm-hmm. Some people have 102, some people have 103 fever, you know, but more or less they have the same. They feel crummy, not horrible crummy, but crummy enough. They get vesicular rash, which means they have oozing bubbles, and that lasts about 7 to 10 days, and then they get better. That's the situation. Now, 100% of those people will have literally millions of copies of the virus in their blood. They also have thousands, maybe millions of copies of viruses in their, you know, vesicular fluid. Because a virus is, I think somebody said, a billionth of a centimeter. So we're talking, you know, if there's 3 billion bacteria in a teaspoon of soil, there's hundreds of billion viruses in that same soil. So we're talking about millions, maybe more viruses. So then you can take those millions of viruses, you see them on an electron microscope. That's how we see them, because they're too small to be seen in a normal microscope. And then you can purify the culture. And that means you have only a culture of those viruses. You can then expose an animal and they'll get symptoms just like chickenpox or whatever the equivalent of chickenpox is for a monkey or a rat. And then you'll have viruses from them, and you can expose the next animal, and then so on and so on. That's what Koch's postulates mean. That's how we prove that this set of symptoms was not from Chernobyl, not because of an apple fell on everybody's head in Georgia, or it was actually an infective agent. Now, I've had some criticism over the last few days saying, well, we don't use Koch's postulates anymore. They're out of date. And I'll get into that. But the fact is, that's not true. In fact, there is a recent study about this current coronavirus situation that attempted to prove Koch's postulates right now. So it's not true that these are the principles for how we demonstrate infection as the cause.
Okay.
But I'll get into why we don't use Koch's postulates a little bit later.
Okay.
So let me then say, so what should have happened in this current outbreak? Which, as I will say, as far as I know, and if somebody has evidence that I'm wrong, I would love to see it. But as far as I know, this didn't happen. So let's say there was 500 people in somewhere, let's say in some city in China, that had a new set of symptoms. They should have called up the local virologist, the local CDC, whatever they call them, or if they didn't have that, or they're not as sophisticated or whatever, which I think they are, they call up the American CDC and say, we have 500 people with the exact same symptoms. We want to know what the cause is. The first trouble is what they're saying is the people actually don't have particularly characteristic symptoms. They have a low-grade fever and a dry cough. Now, the problem is lots of people have dry coughs and lots of people have low-grade fevers. They could have the flu, they could have a cold, they could have asthma, they could be exposed to air pollution. There's lots of things. So that set of symptoms, unlike meningococcus or chickenpox, doesn't really help. But then you would have taken these 500 people. Okay, we think this is a different kind of dry cough and low-grade fever. Let's take these 500 people and examine their blood and demonstrate that all of them have millions of copies of this new coronavirus in their blood or in their lung tissue. And again, as far as I know, not only didn't that happen with 500 people, not only didn't that happen with 100 people, not only didn't that happen with 10 people, I'm not sure it happened with anybody. Now, they took people's respiratory sputum, you know, and they examined it under electron microscope, and I've seen the pictures, and you see all kinds of things, including a coronavirus. But you see other viruses, you see debris, you see proteins, you see, you know, if you look at somebody's respiratory secretions, obviously there's going to be a lot in there. What they saw was a coronavirus amongst everything else. They then essentially looked at that coronavirus under a microscope and said, this has a different genetic material than the usual one. The genetic material of a coronavirus is RNA, not DNA. And so we think this is a new virus. Okay, fair enough. They may have seen a new virus. In fact, they probably did see a new virus. But they didn't demonstrate that that new virus is in millions of copies in everybody. And then the next thing is, if I was the CDC investigator, I would have said, show me 500 normal people, approximately the same age and the same health status. So in other words, if you took 500 people who all had lung disease, that's not really the same. So you have to match them to the 500 people who are sick. And you would look in there and say, how many of them have an example of this coronavirus in their respiratory secretions or blood, right? Because it should be zero. As far as I know, not only was that not done with 500 controls, it was not done with 100 controls, it was not done with 10 controls, it wasn't done with anybody. So that's a problem, because how do you know? Now, the next thing is, they did take that respiratory secretions, and I've read the original articles that came out postulating that this was a new infection with this coronavirus. Quote, they said, we did not attempt to purify the virus. So what does that mean? They took the respiratory secretions that had this new virus, coronavirus, but has, you know, millions of other viruses maybe, or 10 others maybe, and a whole lot of toxic stuff. And they injected it down the throat of some animal and or in the nose, and some of the animals got sick. Now, not all of the animals. And then, in fact, one study, they couldn't get normal mice sick, so-called wild mice. So they used genetically defective mice, and those are the mice that got sick when they injected them with this unpurified snot, excuse my French. Now, I don't know about you, but that doesn't sound like proof to me. This is not the first rodeo here. Let me give you another example. And again, please don't ask me for references. They are meticulously referenced in the book called Virus Mania. In the late 1800s, there was a new disease of paralysis of basically the limbs of particularly children, but sometimes other people. And again, nobody knew what it was. It happened to be the same time as they started spraying orchards with a chemical called lead arsenic. Now, then they did pathology examinations and autopsies on people who died and found out that there's a certain part of the nervous system called the anterior horn cells of the spinal cord, which are affected, which is what was essentially leading to the paralysis. It turns out that lead arsenic is a specific toxin for that part of the nervous system. But there were some people there who said, because this was the heyday of Pasteur and the whole germ theory, and they said, no, this must be an infection. So it was called polio. Now, they then tried to transmit the infection because they didn't have electron microscopes, I think. So they couldn't see any transmissible agent. There was no bacteria. They couldn't find it with controls. In other words, normal people, they didn't see the bacteria. Polio people, they didn't see it. So they said it must be something smaller than a bacteria, but they couldn't find it. So they said, well, the only thing we can do is try to transmit it to a healthy animal and see if they get sick. So that's what they did. So they took basically ground up brains from people who died, or the spinal cord of people who were paralyzed, had monkeys drink them, and none of them got sick. And then they said, okay, we'll inject it subcutaneously, like in the arm of a monkey. And nobody got sick. And they were determined, I've heard, I don't know if this is the exact number, but they used over 500,000 monkeys to try to prove this. Eventually then, somewhere around 1906, 1908, again, the reference is in the Virus Mania book, they did an experiment to prove it. So they took two monkeys, they took the diseased spinal cord of a child who was paralyzed, they ground it up, they drilled holes in the monkey's skull. They injected about a quarter of a cup of this unpurified diseased spinal material into these two monkeys' brains. One died and the other became paralyzed. you can see a picture of the researcher holding up the paralyzed monkey. And that was the proof that polio was a transmissible disease. The biggest outbreak of polio ever, because there's interestingly another poison that affects exactly that part of the brain, which is called the anterior horn cells of your nervous system. And that's called DDT. So they introduced DDT sometime in the 20s or 30s. And then there was an increase. And then the biggest outbreak ever was in Detroit. It happened to be where I was growing up in the late 50s. By this time, they could examine people. And of the people who got polio, 51% had evidence of a virus. The other 49% didn't. Again, you can find the references to this. You could ask the question, what happened to the other 49% then? Obviously, the whole thing, well, it's a bit crazy. And this led then to a whole lot of other diseases having the same thing happen. We're talking Hep C, we're talking SARS, we're talking H5N1, we're talking Ebola, we're talking Zika, we're talking H1N1. In no case did they do this Koch's postulates, same symptoms, find the virus in millions of cases in a certain affected fluid, find it in nobody who's not sick, transfer it, prove infection.
That was part of an interview with Dr. Tom Cowan on the Wise Traditions podcast, hosted by Hilda Labrada-Gore. Now, Dr. Cowan also went into detail in this interview about the testing kits and how the kits don't test to determine viral causation. You'll hear now that he goes into more detail regarding what is a virus, what are the implications to viral contagion in regard to a toxic environment, including wireless radiation such as 5G millimeter waves. Let's have a listen to this part.
Now we can turn to what is a cause and what is a virus. Now, for this, I want to refer particularly health professionals and medical doctors to a lecture given by one of the most prominent virologists in the world named Skip Burgin. The lecture, you can see it on YouTube, was the 2014 NIH annual lecture on the state of virology. And by the way, I'm not saying that this Dr. Burgin agrees with me, but here's what he said. He said, look, people, we have millions of viruses in our so-called virome, which is the equivalent of the microbiome. You know, back when I was in medical school, we knew nothing about a microbiome, meaning the bacteria that live in your gut and in your eyelid and your nose and everywhere else in your body. So we tried to sterilize people who were sick. We would give them lots of antibiotics, sometimes radiate them with x-rays to try to sterilize their bodies so that they would stop being sick. So now we have this theory that viruses come from the outside and they're, you know, these wily attack things. And you don't have any normal viruses in you. Well, as he pointed out, 20% of our DNA at least is viruses. And we have millions of different viruses living in every orifice, crack, blood, cell, everything in our body. In fact, it's very difficult to know what is viruses and what isn't. In other words, as he said, viruses are messages. They are the rapid response team. In other words, if you encounter danger, your body makes it liberates or a piece of genetic material, which is what a virus is. Mm-hmm. It buds out through your cell membrane, which is what a virus is. It's called exosomes. This then goes to other cells and other tissues and sends them the message that we have been poisoned, we should do something. It's very similar in a way to what a tree does. If a tree in a forest gets eaten by beetles or something like that, then it sends out messages through its roots telling the other trees to make an immunological reaction against the beetles. This is how cells, how tissues, organisms, and even between species communicate with each other. In other words, I've been poisoned. Something bad happened. It could even be a quote infection, but we're going to flesh that out a little bit. Mm-hmm. Something happened, usually a poison. The poison degrades your DNA. By the way, the DNA is encased in crystalline water, like I described in my book. I have irrefutable evidence of this. Please don't ask me for the reference. It will be in my next thing that I write about this. But the DNA The genetic material is encased in this watery crystal. Something happens to disturb the watery crystal. It starts replicating a new piece of DNA or RNA, or the DNA becomes RNA. That's a more technical way to say it. Mm-hmm. And packages that up, sends it out as messengers that tell the other organisms there's something happening here. This is why it looks like it's contagious. You're sending a signal, a message to another organism that something happened here, you need to make an immunological reaction. That's why it's complicated. And as Dr. Virgin said at the end, they said, man, Skip, this is incredibly complicated. And he said, appropriately enough, I know, don't blame me. That's how life is. This is incredibly complicated. In other words, we have injury. We have packages of communication devices packaged in your own cells. And that's why these PCR tests, if you look hard enough, we do have that piece of RNA in there. In fact, I would even go so far as to say a woman named Barbara McClintock, and again, the references are in the Virus Mania book, she proved that even the DNA is flexible. So an injury happens, you can actually have, she didn't say the watery matrix, but I would say the crystalline water changes the DNA, makes a new genetic material, it gets packaged up, and that's what we call viruses. And that's what looks like contagion. Now, here's one model of viral infection, that we have these, quote, wily viruses. Now, again, a virus is a piece of genetic material, either RNA or DNA, some proteins, and then a cell membrane from you. So the theory is, wily virus, you're just going around minding your own business. Virus attacks you, makes millions of copies of itself, and then you're sick. So here's five viral diseases: chickenpox, measles, German measles, mumps, and hand, foot, and mouth disease. Here's the next question. Have you ever seen a human being with any one of those diseases? In other words, you've seen it.
I've seen it, yeah.
And tell me if I'm wrong, but your understanding is before 1950, for instance, there was millions of people who got chickenpox, measles, mumps, you know, hand, foot, and mouth, and German measles. Now, this would have been an easier question to ask somebody in 1940. So you may have to surmise a little bit. In other words, it's true that there's a lot of people who were, quote, attacked by this virus and then they got symptoms. Now, how many people do you know of who had all five of those at the same time? As far as I know, it's never happened or been reported. How many times have you seen people get three of those at the same time?
Never.
How many two?
Nope,
never happens. As far as I know, it's never even been reported. Now, if this was simply a virus attacking you, why couldn't two viruses attack you at the same time? I would submit there's two possible explanations for that. One, there's something really wrong with that theory. Mm-hmm. Or two, in the history of the last, say, 200 years or whatever, not once has a child or a human being been exposed to two viruses at the same time. I would say that is frankly impossible. Everybody was exposed to chickenpox, measles, you know, mumps. And then they say, well, but it attacks the same tissue. But there's still lots of cells that are unaffected. And then what about mumps? Mumps attacks your parotid gland. So why couldn't you have one virus attack your parotid gland and another attack your respiratory and another attack your skin?
Yeah, and if I were a wily virus, I'd go after someone that already had one kind.
Yeah, why not? There's mm-hmm. something else happening here. So let's go back to the virus is messenger theory. In other words, the people were poisoned. They send out a distress signal. Because we are a unified system, I would say we are a living, breathing, crystalline water being. And at any one time, it has one response, which is, I've been poisoned in this way. I'm going to send out the signal to my friends and relatives and everybody in the world, maybe, and that's going to alert them. You can't do two unified responses at the same time. It's just crazy. So you do one, then you get done with the one. And then you say, well, why does this happen to everybody, every child which, you know, got chickenpox? It could be, as many people have not only suggested, but actually in a sense proven, that there are certain sort of elimination phenomenons or this sort of messenger phenomena that all children have to go through in order to become healthy. It's part of the actual maturation process. So every child will be susceptible to, okay, here's the message. Okay, I'm going to do that too. It's a pretty harmless event. And then I'm going to have a physical antibody produced, which is the sort of physical marker that I've had that. I never get chickenpox again. And then I have less glioblastoma and less arthritis the rest of my life. That's why these diseases look very contagious. And that, I would submit, perfectly explains all the observable phenomena of essentially the history of viral diseases. And so that's layer two. Layer one is virus infection, but they didn't prove it. Layer two is there's more happening here, virus as messenger. Now, some people then say, and I haven't spoken about this yet, and this gets even more esoteric, and all we're doing is saying, how does Tom see the world? You know, I could be right and I could not be right. But here I go. So people say, yes, but it spreads all over the world. How can that be? Well, first of all, how can it be if it's a virus? Second of all, how could that be if it's a message, which is really the same question. Here we get into what is the nature of any physical substance? And, you know, I think I've said to you before, if you say, so what is a virus? What is any molecule? A molecule is made out of atoms. What is an atom? Well, it's a nucleus that's here, and I'm putting my finger here. And then there's an electron over there in Oakland, which is way far away. And what's in between? Space, i.e. nothing. And then to make it even more complicated, the physicists say this stuff that we're made of called atoms, like viruses are made of atoms, just like we are made of atoms. So not only is it 99.99% space, how come a virus looks solid? Nobody knows. Nobody knows how anything looks solid. But then they tell us, mind-bogglingly enough, that some of the time it looks like a particle, which is 99% space, but the other time it's just a wave. It's not even any particle. And so it's just an energy form that then somehow crystallizes by some way we don't know into an atom, a particle, and then into stuff we call a rock or a human being. Now, if that's true, which is what the physicists say, mm-hmm. and it's basically the picture of the holographic picture of the universe, then what happens is we have these energy forms, which then presumably circulate all around the Earth. Now, I know that's going to be hard for people to swallow, but that's what the physicists basically tell us. It's like the 100th monkey phenomenon. It's like proving that prayer in one place affects the outcome of physical events in another place. For those who want references for that, read Larry Doocy. So then the question is, what is this energy form that's circulating around the planet that's causing people to be sick? So that's a big question. So I'm going to stop there for a minute. And those are the three layers. There's more, but I'm not going to get into even more of how to understand what's happening at this time. We are crystallized energy, period. And so that makes things a lot more fluid and flexible than you have to spew out a messenger or you have to spew out a virus. I mean, in 1918, they couldn't even guess as to why people on a boat and people in South Africa and people in Chile all got it at the same time. They didn't have anything to do with each other. So what I'm essentially saying is, there is something that's poisoning us, that's causing DNA degradation, which is then being seen as this, quote, novel virus or new messenger, that in itself is a kind of crystallized or physical manifestation of an energetic impulse. So the question then is, what is this toxic influence that's hurting us? Now, I will fully acknowledge that I can't know that right now. But here's what I can say. When you look at the places that are, we know that the people have, you know, an immunological, i.e. febrile reaction, they have a cough, and some of them are even having hemorrhages or bleeding in their lungs. And now they're even blaming heart attacks on this. In other words, what is happening to these people's lungs that's creating this new toxic insult? So you look at a place like Wuhan. So what do they have there? First of all, they have one of the most polluted with God knows what cities or places in the world. You can barely see the ground.
Wow.
Second of all, they hyper-vaccinated the people in the weeks and months before this. So in other words, they were shooting them full of metallic aluminum, which, by the way, causes an immunological reaction, a cytokine storm, so to speak, which is what they're saying is happening with this current epidemic, right? So you get a cytokine storm from the immunization, the injection of aluminum. There's aluminum in the air. There's all kind of other toxins in the air. There's the accentuation of the normal electromagnetic fields. And then, as far as we can tell, there's the introduction of a novel electromagnetic field called 5G. All I know is they say they rolled out these new energy forms. So what does this new energy form do? So here we have a situation of God knows what in their lungs, injecting them with substances whose goal is to produce an immunological cytokine reaction. And then they introduce a new electromagnetic field impulse into these people, which has very good evidence that it happens. One is these new electromagnetic fields interferes with the oxygen bioavailability. So in other words, even the oxygen in the entire planet has decreased by at least 1 or 2% in the last 100 years. And then you have an air polluted up the wazoo city, which is, by the way, exactly the same in northern Italy. And so the oxygen level goes down. And then you introduce an electromagnetic field, which further reduces the oxygen bioavailability, and then you get lung lesions. So here's another thing that the 5G or all electromagnetic fields do. I'm talking about non-native ones. If you don't believe me, go to Furstenberg's book and you'll see the evidence. They degrade DNA and RNA. They're causing degradation of your genetic material, which the body packages up as these novel messages. Number three, they interfere with the distribution of calcium in and across the cell membrane. Now, I admit this one is controversial, and I've seen some evidence for it and some evidence against it. But the reason I think there's something to it is because if you introduce a new electromagnetic field and that causes the calcium to be pushed into the cell, you will end up with toxic cells, which is what you see, and lowered calcium in the blood. And the calcium is part of the coagulation pathway. In other words, if you lower the calcium in your blood, you will start bleeding, which is exactly what happened to the people in 1918. Most of the deaths were actually ascribed to hemorrhages.
That was again Dr. Tom Cowan in an interview on Wise Traditions podcast. All of this information has gone mainstream, by the way. Investors, business firms, and Bloomberg News have started their campaign to counter the spread of information, calling into focus how fifth generation millimeter wave radiation can cause negative human health impacts and accelerate the spread of a contagion. But as you'll notice, there isn't any scientific data backing up their claims of how safe 5G is. In this article, for example, 5G coronavirus conspiracy theory spurs rash of telecom tower arson fires by Thomas Seal and Bloomberg. And here's the article. Telecom masts that enable the next generation of wireless communication were set on fire in the UK in recent days, apparently by people motivated by a theory that the tech helps spread the coronavirus. Investors are taking note. Quote, most will laugh at this scientifically unproven claim, but we should not underestimate public worry about potential adverse health impacts of 5G due to radiation and thus a possible drag on the 5G progress in democratic countries. Analyst led by Edison Lee at Jefferies Financial Group, Inc. said in a note. While there's absolutely no evidence to support the idea that 5G technology contributes to COVID-19 spread, the conspiracy is being shared widely on social media. Mast fires, the 5G antennas, mast fires were reported in Belfast, Liverpool, and Birmingham, according to local media. A video of a telecom tower on fire was circulated on a Birmingham community webpage, and Facebook removed a group which encouraged users to share footage of equipment being destroyed. 5G is being rolled out by all four UK mobile carriers, BT Group, Vodafone, Telefonica, and CK Hutchison Holdings. Counterterrorism police are investigating, according to Vodafone UK's chief executive officer, Nick Jeffrey. The incidents prompted the networks to denounce the act in a joint statement on Sunday, while Britain's Department for Digital, Culture, Media and Sport tweeted that criminal acts inspired, quote, crackpot conspiracy theories circulating online will face, quote, the full force of the law. And Thomas Seal continues, the government has set up special units to combat misinformation about the virus and says it's pressing social media companies, quote, for further action to stem the spread of falsehood and rumor, which could cost lives. Media regulator Ofcom last week sanctioned a small radio station for featuring a guest who claimed 5G caused the pandemic. Hollyweird actor Woody Harrelson shared the theory on his Instagram account last week. Now, listeners, a guest who claimed 5G caused the pandemic. So that's very different from what Martin Paul is saying. We have scientific medical evidence showing long-term exposure to 4G radiation, for example, wireless radiation, and 5G millimeter wave radiation causes responses in the body that then have a set of symptoms, including cancer. So the article continues. Concerns about links between the new tech and cancer were already slowing the rollout of 5G in countries including Switzerland, Bloomberg Businessweek previously reported, despite a lack of scientific support for the claims. There is no lack of scientific support for the claim, Thomas Seal, who should get a Peabody Award now for this level of journalism. Last month, the independent global health body, the International Commission on Non-Ionizing Radiation Protection, deemed 5G safe, writes Thomas Seal. Quote, public fear, if it's not fact-based, can pressure governments to act if it is big enough, the Jefferies analyst wrote. Quote, with so many unknowns as to the nature of COVID-19, it's not surprising that people might believe any theories, no matter how baseless. Okay, this is really interesting the way it's going. Investment groups say most will laugh at this scientifically unproven claim. So economic analysts and investor groups have now become scientists and doctors. Let's hear again what Dr. Martin Paul said last month about 5G and the impacts of human health.
Okay. Well, in order to understand that, you need to understand both how electromagnetic fields, EMFs, work in our bodies. And then you also have to understand what kinds of things are involved in the coronavirus infection, the production of new coronaviruses. So let's take them one at a time. The way in which EMFs work in the cells of our bodies, and this is, you know, I've published now 8 papers on this mechanism, is that the EMFs activate certain channels which are in the membrane that surrounds our cells. So every cell in our body has a membrane around it called the plasma membrane. And one of the things that you find in these plasma membranes are some channels called voltage-gated calcium channels. And that's all a big thing. The way in which the EMFs work is they activate these channels. They open up the channel, so the channel is closed most of the time. And when that channel opens up, you get huge amounts of calcium flowing into the cell. Okay, so the calcium concentration outside of cells is usually about 10,000 times higher than it is inside the cells. So when you open up these channels, you get huge amounts of calcium flowing in. And it's the excess of calcium in the cell that produces most of the effects that we see from these EMF exposures. And the problem with 5G is that it is extremely highly pulsed, as as well as being a very high frequency. And the pulsations are very important in terms of activating these channels and producing effects. So the pulsed EMFs in general are much more active than our non-pulsed EMFs. So these are pulses that are modulating pulses which modulate the underlying frequency of the field. So this is the way in which wireless communication works, through these pulsations. The pulsations carry the information. And 5G is designed to be extraordinarily highly pulsed in order to carry huge amounts of information per second. And this is, of course, what the industry is touting. They're saying 5G is wonderful because it carries huge amounts of information, and you can download videos almost instantaneously, et cetera, et cetera. You know, that's what I'm sure all of us have heard their ads about it. And it's true, you can communicate much faster than with anything else. And that's because 5G pulses much more than anything else. And that makes 5G much more dangerous as a consequence of that, because the impacts on our bodies are much higher. The cells in our bodies are much higher. That's the first issue here.
Dr. Paul, when you were on last February, we went over in detail the voltage-gated calcium channels.
Okay.
And it was very interesting to understand how the effects, such as leukemia, cardiac disease, diabetes, sleep disturbances, dementia, weight loss, mm-hmm. weight gain, weakened immune system, allergies, arthritis, nausea, memory, and concentration problems, and much more, including cancer, all relate back to the addition of calcium. So that was very interesting to understand mm-hmm. that realm. Mm-hmm. But now we're talking about viruses and in mm-hmm. terms of a weakened immune system. Mm-hmm. And we do not hear any warnings about, please stay away from wireless routers. Do not use your cell phone if you are contagious. And would you say that would be an important warning in addition to washing your hands?
I think with regard specifically to the coronavirus, I think it is. I don't think the main effect is the immune system, however. There are a number of different things that happen, you know, when we activate these channels and we get excessive intracellular calcium. We get oxidative stress. As a consequence of that, we get increases in something called NF-kappa-B, which is an important regulatory molecule that produces large amounts of inflammation, things that are called inflammatory cytokines. All those things I just mentioned, excessive intracellular calcium, the oxidative stress, NF-kappa-B elevation, and inflammation. Those four things all have important roles in the coronavirus infection, and it makes the infection, I think, much more virulent because of each of those factors. And so what you end up with then is a much faster generation of new viruses that can then go and infect other parts of the body and also can get out of the body and infect other people. So this is an important part of the spread. You know, this is going to stimulate the spread of the virus, the coronavirus, in the epidemic. So that's very dangerous. And there's one other thing which is also produced from this these effects from the EMFs, and that is you get increases in apoptosis, programmed cell death. That's an important mechanism in the release of the virus. So the viruses, you know, kill the cells, and then they get released from those cells, and then they can go and infect other cells and other organisms as a consequence of that. And so what that predicts then is that 5G is going to greatly exacerbate the each of these infections in humans. And the reason that this is particularly important is because, you know, we know that this epidemic started in Wuhan, China. Wuhan, China is China's first 5G city. They call it a smart 5G city. is also the location of China's first 5G highway, where they could use 5G radiation for self-driving vehicles. And there were 10,000 antennae put into 5G antennae put into Wuhan, China. As far as I can tell, that is by far the largest number of 5G antennae have been put in anywhere in the world. And when you have, you know, these effects of the 5G radiation then acting on our bodies when they're infected by coronavirus to exacerbate the infection, and that's a big problem, obviously. There's another big problem, and that is that the predominant cause of death in the coronavirus infection, you know, it's now being called the COVID-19 infection, is pneumonia. So we know that that pneumonia is exacerbated by those same five factors that I talked about before that are produced by the EMFs: excessive intracellular calcium, oxidative stress, NF-kappa-B elevation, inflammation, and apoptosis. All five of those are involved in pneumonia, so they make the pneumonia much worse. You can see how in both of those ways that the 5G radiation can make the whole system much worse. And I've been told, and here I have not looked up the information, so I can't tell you that this is correct, but I've been told that the areas in Italy and in South Korea where we've had the biggest epidemics outside of China also have 5G in those same areas.
You're right about that. And I haven't looked up South Korea, but northern Italy, specifically Milan.
Yeah.
Marketing directors discuss how excited they are that they've entered the world of 5G.
So I think this is a big issue, and I think that it is something that we have to pay very close attention to. Of course, the Seattle area in the U.S. has 5G, which is you know, is the biggest epidemic we have in this country at this point. And so I have to say, in general, you know, we've had every expectation that 5G radiation would be much more dangerous than the previous, you know, types of exposures that we've had, which are already having major impacts on humans. You know, the safety guidelines that are supposed to protect us from this radiation are based entirely on heating effects, that is what they call thermal effects. So that these effects that go via the Bollinger-Gated calcium channels are not protected at all by the safety guidelines. And so the safety guidelines simply don't tell you anything about safety. It's just a complete misnomer. So we have a situation where many of us have argued you should not put out 5G without extensive biological safety testing. There has been no biological safety testing of genuine 5G radiation with all of its pulsations. And they're just rushing ahead with putting this out all over the place in complete disregard to the impacts on our health. So I find this absolutely abominable situation that we're in.
We've just heard Dr. Martin Paul from last month discussing human health impacts in direct connection with exposure to fifth-generation wireless millimeter wave radiation. This is in response to the Fortune.com article by Thomas Steele and Bloomberg, which contain this information, quote, "Concerns about links between the new tech and cancer were already slowing the rollout of 5G in countries including Switzerland," Bloomberg Businessweek previously reported, despite a lack of scientific support for the claim. Last month, the independent global health body, the International Commission on Non-Ionizing Radiation Protection, deemed 5G safe. We know this information is untrue, yet for some reason, Thomas Steele and Bloomberg find that it's okay to write this out in their online publications. I'm not sure if there's a physical version of this Fortune.com article, but here we have substantial misinformation being broadcast out to people regarding the safety of 5G technology, which means there is a level of desperation here, listeners, that I've actually not seen before. Now, most of us know something isn't right with this virus and contagion, as all roads are leading to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And according to the CDC and WHO reports, both of these agencies have connections to Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. But in their own reports, world economies did not have to shut down for this pandemic. Wall Street on Parade points to this pandemic was used as a cover for a financial reset. In addition, earthquake and volcanic activity suggest paying attention to larger gravitational events that could be influencing fault lines across the planet. We have resources at our fingertips, and many are setting the example by disconnecting from the mainstream, lies and deception, trusting intuition, and sharing independent research. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.